Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. On September 11th, 1857, a group of 120 immigrants to California was attacked and slaughtered by Mormon settlers and their Indian allies. 20 years later, John D. Lee, a Mormon and a participant in this massacre, was executed by a firing squad at the same spot and thus entered history as the scapegoat for all those responsible for what came to be known as the Mountain Meadow Massacre in southern Utah. Red Water by Judith Freeman, published in January of 2002, is the story of the life of John D. Lee as told by three of his 19 wives. Judith Freeman describes early Mormon belief, the sense of persecution felt by the Mormons, and the sisterhood of his wives in marriage. Judith Freeman grew up in a large Mormon family in Utah and now describes herself as a lapsed Mormon. When I spoke with her by phone, I asked her to describe John D. Lee, who he was, what kind of a character he was, and how he fits in to Mormon history.
Well, John D. Lee is the man most closely associated with what is known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And he was a convert to Mormonism. He was born in Illinois, and he made the trek west with the Mormons, came to Utah in about 1849. He was Brigham Young's adopted son. He was a polygamist. He had about 12 wives by the time he arrived in Utah. Some of those wives ended up leaving him. So at any one point, he had 8 or 9 wives. He was sent by Brigham Young to colonize southern Utah to establish the first fort there, and in an area that was so rugged and so harsh and where there were no whites. He became farmer to the Indians. He learned a little bit of the Indian language and befriended some of the tribes in that area. But the thing that he really is known for is as the only person who was ever tried and executed for the massacre at Mountain Meadows.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that massacre? What happened? What was involved?
The Mormons had been in Utah for about 8 or 9 years when the federal government decided to send troops to march against the territory, largely because they thought that Brigham Young was trying to create a theocracy in the West. He was trying to create an independent state. Any governor or judge, the federal judge that was sent into the area, was just sort of routinely run off by the Mormons. And they felt that this was a group that was out of control. And so an army was marching against Utah. And at the same time, a wagon train of 120 immigrants from Arkansas came into the Utah Territory in 1857 in late summer. They were on their way to California. It was quite a rich wagon train. There were lots of cattle and gold. And these people, as they came into Utah, they realized that they were entering a kind of hostile environment. The Mormons at that point were really kind of preparing for war with the United States. They did not welcome outsiders. And so the immigrants on this train were unable to buy the supplies that they needed. And a kind of hostility built up between the Mormons and the immigrants from Arkansas. It didn't help that one of the Mormon leaders, an apostle named Parley P. Pratt, had just been killed in Arkansas. And so as the train made its way down through Utah, the more and more hostility grew up until they finally reached a meadow in southern Utah where they planned to camp for a couple of weeks before heading out across the Mojave. And it was there that they were attacked by a band of Paiute Indians. And there's some evidence to indicate that those Indians had more or less been told by Brigham Young that they could have the cattle and all the goods of any wagon train that was headed on the southern route. In other words, my opinion is that the Mormons were really using the Indians to attack that wagon train. And when that didn't work, the Mormons themselves came in, the local settlers. They tricked the immigrants into trusting them. They told them that if they would lay down their arms, and they could march them to safety, lead them to safety. But when the immigrants got out into the open, they were slaughtered by the Mormons, working with their Indian allies. The Mormons immediately blamed that on the Indians, although it's clear that most of the slaughter was done by the local Mormon settlers. And for years, really, no one was brought to justice, even though federal troops arrived in an attempt to find out what happened. It wasn't until 20 years after the massacre itself that John D. Lee was arrested, tried, and executed for his part in the massacre. And in a sense, he became a scapegoat for his people.
Why did it take so long?
Well, the men who were involved in that massacre, the men and the boys, I think the sense of shame that descended was so profound that almost everyone left the area. They went to Arizona or California. They just got out of there. And only John D. Lee stuck around. And it's kind of hard to understand why did he do that. But he was quite a wealthy man, in part because he had taken the cattle from that wagon train and taken some of the goods. And I think he just was, he was arrogant. He thought also that Brigham Young, who had adopted him as his spiritual son, would protect him. And so he stayed in the area, and he lived openly. And every once in a while, federal troops would come looking for him, and he would go into hiding for a while, and then he would go back to his life. And only in the 1870s did he end up going to a very remote outpost on the Colorado River, which has since been named after him, called Lee's Ferry. And there he was hiding for a number of years, trying to evade arrest, but he made the mistake of going to visit one of his wives in a settlement in Utah, and there a federal marshal arrested him. He was tried twice, and at the second trial, the first trial ended in a hung jury, and at the second trial he was convicted and taken back to the meadow and shot.
Tell us a little bit about him. You characterize him as a very charismatic person, one of the few people at the time who was allowed to be a practicing polygamist.
Well, there are actually a number of men who practiced polygamy at the time. It was pretty widespread. I think that he was charismatic and attractive to women. I think he was a good husband and father. I think he was a generous neighbor. I also think he was self-important and that he was a known liar, that he had all sorts of devious qualities and sides to him. He embodied for me both good and evil. And at the end of writing this novel about real historical figures, including John D. Lee, I really had a hard time deciding whether the good outweighed the evil. What he was a man who very much wanted to be loved and liked. He did his religious duty all his life. He was devoted to his church. He was especially devoted to Brigham Young. But he was a man of such complex psychology that, to me, he embodied really a kind of saintly devil.
What drew you to write this book and this story about him?
Well, this is my fourth novel, and it's the only novel that's ever been set in a time other than the present. And I never really thought I'd write a historical novel, but about 6 or 7 years ago, I came across a book called The Mountain Meadows Massacre by Juanita Brooks, written in the 1950s. I grew up as a Mormon, even though I left the church very early on. And in all the time that I was growing up, I had never heard about this massacre. It wasn't until I was an adult that I began to hear sort of faint rumors about something that had happened. Mormons had done something bad, and a lot of people had died. But when I actually read about this massacre, it just obsessed me. It just took hold of me. It just almost demanded that I somehow write about it and that I turn it into fiction. And it seemed that if I could do so, I could find something. I could really begin to understand something about my own history, even though it wasn't a personal story. here were these events in the 19th century that had been so whitewashed. For 100 years, it had been blamed on the Indians. I wanted to know how these very, essentially very good people I had come from, how they could have done such a horrible thing.
Did you find out?
I think in a sense I did, and it's perhaps not so surprising that I believe it was done out of vengeance. It was done out of an excess of religious feeling, fanaticism. It was done to get back at their perceived enemies. Those people in Arkansas had nothing to do with the apostle who died there. They were just from the wrong place at the wrong time. I felt that I came to look at Mormon history differently, quite different than the way that I'd been taught. To me, there was much more violence in early Mormon culture than I ever could have imagined. And in the end, I suppose that I came to feel that people who were persecuted in turn will persecute others. People who are crowded into a very small, mean space will strike back. And people can be persuaded to do almost anything in the name of God, of some sense of righteousness.
Judith, I want to ask you how you chose to have the narrators of this story be three of John D. Lee's 19 wives. But first, I want to tell our listeners that this week we're talking with Judith Freeman about her new novel called Red Water, about a massacre that occurred in 1857 by the Mormons against a group of immigrants to California in southern Utah. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Judith, how is it that you chose the narrators that you did?
Well, when I thought about writing about this massacre, in a sense, it was so horrific. There was no way that I felt that I could come at it directly and try to describe literally what happened. What appealed to me was the idea of trying to tell this story through the women who were married to the man who was most associated with this sort of horrible event. And I chose these three women, Emma, who was an English convert, who married John D. Lee when she was 20 years old. She was his 17th wife. And Rachel, who was one of his first wives. He married Rachel's sister, was actually his first wife, and then he married Rachel, and then he married another one of their sisters, and then he married their widowed mother. That in itself was kind of so wild and crazy to me that he could have married that many women from one family.
Was that uncommon at the time?
For a man to marry a set of sisters? No, in fact, it was very common. They often married two or three sets of sisters.
But the sister's mother?
The sister's mother really blew me away. I thought, wow, now she was widowed. And Rachel later said that he married her mother for her soul's sake. In other words, I think that that often happened, that there was no such thing as widows just being left and cast off. Sometimes they were married to men without the idea that the marriage would ever be consummated, but really out of an act of charity. Anyway, Rachel and her sister Agatha were both married to John D. Lee. Rachel was the most devoutly religious of the three women I wrote about. I thought that was an interesting perspective. And then the third woman I chose to write about was a woman named Anne Gorge Lee. And she married John D. Lee when she was only 13 years old, and he was 56. And he had the attitude that if they were big enough, they were old enough to be married, in other words. And she was a big, strong girl, and she was his 19th wife, his last wife. She was a very interesting figure to me because she left a memoir at the end of her life called My Life with a Saintly Devil. And there were just wonderful stories in that memoir, and I could hear her voice so clearly. She came through in such a strong way that I felt that she would be a wonderful guide.
That's an interesting contradiction in characterization of her husband, Saintly Devil.
Right. And I mean, she got it right. He really was. It was a very apt title for him, the saintly devil.
In your research for this book, where did you look? What were your sources? Who did you talk to?
Well, I had a friend named Will Bagley, a man who became a friend, a historian in Utah, who has written his own book about Mountain Meadows, which will be published in a couple of months, a nonfiction book called Blood of the Prophets. And it's the first book to be written in a very long time to take a look at these events. And Will Bagley was just amazingly generous with me, and he put me on to all kinds of things. He gave me, for instance, the manuscript of My Life with a Saintly Devil, which had only recently turned up. It had been stored in a shoebox in someone's closet. And then suddenly it had just come to light, this remarkable document written by one of Lee's wives. I also read the diaries of John D. Lee, the journals of John D. Lee. He kept faithful journals all of his life, and they are really interesting documents that tell so much about daily life in early Mormon Utah. And he talks a great deal about his wives. So that was very helpful. I went to the Huntington Library, and I did research on Indians, Native American tribes, in the area in which the Mormons settled, because they figured a large part into the story, and I wanted to understand more about that. And then I also used the Utah Historical Society, which is just a rich trove of information on early Western history. And I'm not really an academic or a scholar. I never really even went to college, so I'm a self-taught writer, and it was really a tremendous challenge for me in the beginning to even learn how to use a library. So in the beginning, it was intimidating, and then it really became exciting reading history.
Judith, is there a portion of the book that you would like to read for us?
Yes, there is. There's a scene here where Emma has gone with her husband, John D. Lee, to deliver a lamb, something to a farm, and it's the first time that Emma meets Anne, this young 13-year-old, who she suddenly, slowly realizes is going to be John D. Lee's next wife.
And his last wife.
So here's just this section. This is Emma's voice, and the only thing you should know is that all of his wives have been told to call him father. I can recall very clearly the first time I saw her. She lived on a farm near the settlement of Beaver with her mother and stepfather and her younger brother, David. Her stepfather had bought a ewe from father, and we stopped there to deliver it one day. Just as we were preparing to leave, I turned to see someone standing silhouetted against the light in the doorway of the barn, a tall figure cast in shadow, so tall that I first mistook her for her mother. Once she stepped outside, however, I saw her for what she was, just a girl. Very tall and very large-boned, but nonetheless, just a girl. "Here's Brother Lee," her stepfather said to her. "You remember him, don't you, Anne?" "Yes," she said, not smiling, not showing any eagerness at all. She had long black hair that fell loose about her shoulders. She had large blue eyes. She had brown tanned feet, and her limbs were long and well-formed. An attitude of directness and of surety permeated her being in spite of her youth. She stood tall and straight, looking at father in the most calm and engaging fashion. "The last time you came, you promised to bring me something," she said. "Did you bring me something?" "Well, now," father said, "I believe I do have something for a certain girl. Let's just look here in this wagon." We all walked over to the wagon together. The girl, her stepfather, father, myself, and Rachel, who had accompanied us on our journey. The girl wore no shoes, and her feet were the same color as the earth. Her dress had been mended in many places and seemed too small for her. Yet even in this poor outfit, she had a natural grace that her sad attire couldn't diminish. Her skin was honey-colored and smoothed by her youth, and her lips were tinged with pink, as if painted. All in all, she was an unusually comely girl, and I felt a blackness arise in my breast as I looked at her. I knew it by its name of jealousy. Father walked beside her and took her hand. I knew very well then what was happening, what had been happening, perhaps, for some time, just as I knew how powerless I was to stop it. From the wagon, Father produced a coil of satin ribbon that we had just purchased that morning in Parowan, ribbon I had hoped to use to trim a dress I was making for my daughter Alice. I believe this might look very pretty in a certain young girl's hair, he said, and placed the ribbon in her hands. She thanked him and pressed the ribbon to her breast, and then she looked up at him, and in that look, so full of knowing, I saw the dissolution of my future.
So at that time, Emma was 30, the person whose voice you just spoke.
Yes.
And John Lee was 56, and Anne was about 13, and Rachel, the other wife, who was also there, was about 50?
Right. It was kind of extraordinary, the age range in John D. Lee's wives. They could spread from 13 to the middle 50s, probably.
Well, Judith, in writing this book and having it published, what kind of reaction have you received from the Mormon community, and perhaps from your friends and relatives who are still practicing Mormons?
The reaction so far has been kind of muted. The church has only made one statement in response to a question by a journalist for an article in the Salt Lake Tribune. And basically, they were asked how they could explain the massacre, and the church's line is that the massacre was an unfortunate affair committed by local fanatics. There really hasn't been any official response to my book, and I doubt there will be.
Do you think that's a true characterization, an unfortunate affair committed by local fanatics?
No, I don't. I uncovered in my own research evidence that really indicates that events were set in motion in the North by the highest authorities of the church. It wasn't just a group of renegade local Mormons. What they really were was very good Mormons who were told what to do and who did it. And I think the church has yet to sort of own up to the part that Brigham Young played and the part that the authorities of the church played in setting into motion the events that led to the massacre.
The story that you've written and what you've learned in writing it occurred well after you left the Mormon Church. Why did you leave?
It just wasn't ever a very good fit. You know, even when I was a kid, I was rebellious. And I guess, you know, some kids are just like that. But for me, when I got older into more of an age of consciousness, when I could actually express things and think things through, I realized that it's a very patriarchal church, and women find themselves in a kind of secondary position. It's too authoritarian. It's too structured. It doesn't have enough room for the kind of questioning that was beginning to happen in my life, and I just felt that it didn't work for me.
Was your departure accepted by your family?
More or less. I mean, I came from a big family of 8 kids, and I wasn't the only one to leave the church. My younger brother did as well. And my parents were basically very generous, very good-hearted, very kind people. And I don't think they were terribly happy when I left the church, when I just sort of, it didn't happen all at once, I just kind of fell away. But to them, what was important was that we loved each other, and that when they put out the call to come home for a family reunion, we all came. And I have to give it to them that they were really able to accept their children going off and leading their own lives.
Are your parents still active Mormons?
Both of my parents died about 8 or 9 years ago. So they're very much missed, but they were very devout Mormons until the day they died. Most of my brothers and my sister are still very active in the church, so I'm sort of the black sheep.
Well, Judith Freeman, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
There was a novel that was published in the last year called Why Did I Ever? by a writer named Mary Robison, R-O-B-I-S-O-N. And this is the first book that she's published in about 10 years. I had read an earlier collection of stories called An Amateur's Guide to the Night, and I thought they were just amazingly good stories. So when I saw this new novel, Why Did I Ever, I was really looking forward to reading it, and I wasn't disappointed. It's just a remarkable book about a woman who's almost completely dysfunctional, has two children, one a drug addict, one who's been somehow sort of involved in some violent event in New York. She's a script doctor who works part-time in Hollywood. The novel is told in 527 very short chapters. If it sounds depressing, it's not. It's one of the funniest books I've read in a very long time. It's very much about survival, about a woman on the edge, learning to cope with all sorts of extraordinary things. She has a tremendously funny, close friend. Their repartee was just really quite extraordinary to me. So I found it really a book for our time, just a sensitive, poignant, funny, profound book.
Well, Judith Freeman, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for talking with me.
Judith Freeman is the author of Red Water. The book she recommends is Why Did I Ever? By Mary Robison. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.